Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is committed to bringing you the stories and perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. From the peace activists demanding an end to war, to indigenous leaders fighting to stop fossil fuel extraction and save the planet. Our independent reporting is only possible because we're funded by you, not by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war or gun violence, not by the oil, gas, coal, or nuclear companies when we cover the climate crisis. We count on your generous support to keep Democracy Now! Going. Please make your donation of $5, $10, or more at democracynow.org. Every dollar counts. Thank you so much. We're counting on you. Stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
And I say to my fellow Australians, thank you for this extraordinary honour. Tonight, the Australian people have voted for change.
In what's being described as a green slide, voters in Australia topple the Prime Minister, ending nearly a decade of Conservative rule. The main issue? Climate. The new Green Labour Coalition Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. We'll get an update from leading Australian climate scientist and activist Tim Flannery. Then this week marks the second anniversary of the police murder of George Floyd. We'll speak with the Washington Post reporters who co-authored the new book, His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice.
Everyone in the world knows how George Floyd died, but our book is about how George Floyd lives. And it talks about his persistence while navigating structures around the country that were laced with systemic racism.
We wanted to write this book in part because we wanted to show how George Floyd had experienced institutional racism over the course of his life, long before he met the state force represented by Derek Chauvin and the Minneapolis Police Department.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's vowed to defend Taiwan if it's attacked by China. He made the remark when questioned during a news conference in Tokyo earlier today.
You didn't want to get involved in the Ukraine conflict militarily for obvious reasons. Are you willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that?
Yes.
You are?
That's a commitment we made. We are not. Look, here's the situation. We agree with a one China policy. We signed on to it and all the attendant agreements made from there. But the idea that it could be taken by force, just taken by force, is just not appropriate. It will dislocate the entire region and be another action similar to what happened in Ukraine.
After Biden spoke, White House officials tried to walk back his comments, which mark a shift from longtime U.S. policy on Taiwan, known as strategic ambiguity. During his trip to Asia, Biden also unveiled a new trade initiative with 12 Indo-Pacific countries as part of an effort to counter China's growing power in the region. On Sunday, hundreds of demonstrators gathered in Tokyo to protest Biden's visit.
Their actions are extremely dangerous now. Japan and the U.S. are trying to conduct a war of aggression on China.
While in Japan, Biden is meeting leaders from the other members of the so-called Quad, Australia, India, and Japan. Australia will be represented by its new Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, who was just sworn in today. Albanese's center-left Labour Party won the most seats in Saturday's election, toppling the right-wing, pro-coal Scott Morrison, who'd served as Australia's Prime Minister since 2018 and ending a decade of Conservative rule. Anthony Albanese addressed supporters after his election.
Together, we can end the climate wars. we can take advantage of the opportunity for Australia to be a renewable energy superpower.
The Australian election has been described as a green slide, with voters strongly backing candidates pushing for stronger climate action. We'll have more on Australia after headlines with leading Australian climate activist and scientist Tim Flannery. President Biden signed a $40 billion military and economic aid package for Ukraine after the legislation was passed with little debate in Congress. The massive spending bill supported by every Democrat in the House and Senate. Over the weekend, the Wall Street Journal revealed the White House is considering deploying special forces inside Ukraine to guard the newly reopened U.S. embassy in Kyiv. This comes as Ukrainian officials give conflicting accounts on the state of negotiations with Russia to end the three-month-long war, as Russia intensifies attack in the eastern Donbass region. On Saturday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky signaled talks could resume soon, saying fighting, quote, will only definitively end through diplomacy. Meanwhile, one of Zelensky's top aides has ruled out more talks until Russia leaves Ukraine and gives up all land seized. In other news on the war, a Russian soldier has been sentenced to life in prison in Ukraine in the first war crimes trial since the invasion. Meanwhile, Russia's cut off gas exports to Finland days after Finland and Sweden formally requested NATO membership. A U.S. military plane carrying nearly 80,000 pounds of baby formula flew from Germany to Indianapolis Sunday as part of an effort to ease the critical shortage in the United States. Meanwhile, Congressmember Ilhan Omar and two dozen other House Democrats have urged the Federal Trade Commission to investigate the baby formula industry, which is controlled by Abbott Laboratories and a few other companies. The shortage is linked in part due to Abbott's closing of a plant in Michigan in February due to contamination concerns first exposed by a whistleblower who was fired. A federal judge in Louisiana has blocked the Biden administration from lifting Title 42, a Trump-era policy which allows the U.S. to expel recently arrived migrants without due process. Biden had vowed to end Title 42 by today, May 23rd, but the judge, who was appointed by Donald Trump, said Title 42 must remain in place until a lawsuit filed by two dozen states is resolved. The public health order has been used to block over 2 million people arriving at the U.S. Mexico border from seeking asylum, a violation of international law. Leaders of the United States' largest Protestant congregation ignored or covered up nearly two decades of sexual abuse allegations against clergy while seeking to protect their own reputations. That's the finding of an independent investigation into the Southern Baptist Convention made public Sunday. The report found Southern Baptist leaders had a list of hundreds of ministers accused of abuse but took no action. It also found survivors and others who reported sexual assault or harassment were, quote, ignored, disbelieved, or met with the constant refrain that the Southern Baptist Convention could take no action, even if it meant that convicted molesters continued in ministry with no notice or warning to their current church or congregation, unquote. The World Health Organization held an emergency meeting Friday to discuss the recent outbreak of monkeypox outside of areas where the virus is endemic. The WHO has documented 120 confirmed or suspected cases, mostly in Europe. There's been one confirmed case in the United States in Boston. Monkeypox is usually spread between people after close skin-on-skin contact, making it far less contagious than the coronavirus. Scientists say the fatality rate for the form of the monkeypox virus being found in Europe is less than 1%. In Afghanistan, the Taliban's ordered all female TV anchors to cover their faces. Some female journalists have publicly criticized the decree, but have agreed to follow the new rules in order to stay on the air. This is Sonia Niazi of Tolo News.
This decree is unpredictable for all female presenters because Islam has not commanded us to cover our faces, and neither are we given such information in Islam. And every Islamic scholar and political figure has opposed this decree.
In solidarity, the male staff at Tolo News also put on face masks in a picture. In Iran, a colonel in the elite Quds force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps was shot dead in Tehran while he sat in his car outside his home. No one has claimed responsibility. Iran's blamed Israel for several past assassinations. Iran's president, Ibrahim Raisi, has vowed to take revenge. France's former ambassador to Haiti has admitted France and the United States effectively orchestrated the 2004 coup that overthrew Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's first democratically elected president. The former ambassador, Thierry Boucard, told the New York Times one benefit of the coup was that it ended Aristide's campaign demanding France pay financial reparations to Haiti. Over the weekend, the New York Times published a special section headlined The Ransom, looking at how France devastated Haiti's economy in the 19th century by forcing Haiti to pay reparations for generations to former French slaveholders after a slave rebellion led to the 1804 Haitian Revolution. A judge in Argentina has ruled the state was responsible for the massacre of more than 400 indigenous people a century ago, calling it a crime against humanity. In 1924, Argentine police and settlers opened fire on Colm and Malcoit indigenous communities as they protested dreadful working and living conditions on cotton plantations, conditions the workers said amounted to slavery. The ruling does not offer victims, relatives, and descendants financial compensation. Instead, it'll require schools in Argentina to teach the history of the massacre and will fund efforts to find victims' remains. In Pennsylvania, progressive Democrat Summer Lee has been declared the winner of last Tuesday's primary for a House seat representing parts of Pittsburgh. She's poised to become the first Black woman to represent Pennsylvania in Congress. Her election is seen as a major defeat for AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which spent more than $2 million on the race as part of a broader effort targeting progressive Democratic candidates. AIPAC's super PAC has also spent over $1.2 million in Texas to help Democratic Congressmember Henry Cuellar, who faces a runoff Tuesday against the progressive Jessica Cisneros. Bernie Sanders has criticized AIPAC spending. He told the New York Times, quote, "This is a war for the future of the Democratic Party." Newly released emails show Ginny Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, personally urged two Arizona state lawmakers to back efforts to overturn Joe Biden's 2020 election victory. Thomas urged the Republican lawmakers to choose a, quote, clean slate of electors in order to fight back against what she claimed was election fraud. This comes as Justice Thomas is facing increasing pressure to recuse himself from cases related to the 2020 election and the January 6th insurrection, in part because his wife took part in the January 6th Stop the Steal rally in Washington. Hillary Clinton's former campaign manager has admitted Clinton personally approved a plan in 2017 to share with the media a since-debunked allegation that Donald Trump's campaign was covertly communicating with a server at Alpha Bank in Russia. The revelation came during the trial of former Clinton campaign lawyer Michael Sussman, who's accused of misleading the FBI during its Trump-Russia probe. The allegations about Trump and Alpha Bank first appeared in Slate.com days before the 2016 election. In other political news, the conservative Archbishop of the Catholic Church in San Francisco has barred House Speaker Nancy Pelosi from receiving communion until she, quote, publicly repudiates her support for abortion. Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione said Pelosi must first confess and receive absolution to what he called a grave sin. And in California, the United Steelworkers Union has filed charges against Chevron with the National Labor Relations Board, alleging the oil giant illegally surveilled and coerced employees at Chevron's Richmond refinery while refusing to bargain in good faith with workers who've been on strike since March 21st. This comes after Chevron reported it made $6.3 billion in profit during the first quarter of the year. On Saturday, about 150 people rallied outside Chevron's San Francisco Bay Area refinery. Joining them was human rights and environmental lawyer Stephen Donziger, who was released from nearly 1,000 days of house arrest last month as part of a years-long legal ordeal that began after he successfully sued Chevron on behalf of Ecuadorian Amazonian indigenous communities.
You can't tell me with these record-breaking profits that we see right now with Chevron and the whole fossil fuel sector, they can't pay a fair wage to the workers who are responsible for keeping this industrial site as safe as possible? It's all connected, isn't it? You know, screwing over the indigenous people of Ecuador, screwing over their own workers, and doing things in this community that are extremely disrespectful to every citizen.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, we look at the green slide in Australia, where the Conservative Prime Minister was toppled, ending nearly a decade of Conservative rule. The main issue, climate. Stay with us.
Conquistador of Mexico, the Zulu and the Navajo, the Belgians in the Congo, short memory. Plantation in Virginia, the Raj in British India, the deadline in South Africa, short memory. The story of El Salvador, the silence of Hiroshima, destruction of Cambodia, short memory. Short memory, my fella. Short memory. Short memory, my fella. Short memory. The sight of hotels by the
Short Memory by the Australian band Midnight Oil. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a stunning electoral victory in Australia, a Green Labor coalition has overturned a decade of Conservative rule in an election driven largely by concern over the climate emergency. Voters Saturday elected Anthony Albanese of the centre-left Labor Party as their new prime minister, defeating the right-wing pro-coal Scott Morrison, who'd served as Australia's prime minister since 2018. The Labor Party also won the most seats in Parliament. Anthony Albanese addressed supporters Saturday.
And I say to my fellow Australians, thank you for this extraordinary honour. Tonight, the Australian people have voted for change. I am humbled by this victory, and I'm honoured to be given the opportunity to serve as the 31st Prime Minister of Australia.
Australian Prime Minister Albanese was sworn in today and immediately flew to Japan to meet with President Biden and other leaders of the Quad. That's Australia, Japan, India, and the United States. The Australian election has been described as a green slide, with voters largely backing candidates pushing for stronger climate action and against Morrison's pro-coal policies. Australia has the least ambitious plans to address the climate crisis than any other nation in the global north, with many climate advocates calling Australia's policies inadequate. Australia's economy has overwhelmingly relied on coal and gas, despite urgent calls to phase out fossil fuels and for the world's richest nations to slash greenhouse gas emissions nearly in half to prevent the most catastrophic effects of the climate crisis. The country's been on the front lines of facing the impacts of the climate catastrophe, with massive wildfires, floods, and drought only expected to worsen if no immediate measures are taken. Response to the election poured in from Oceania, echoing demands for drastic climate action. Fiji's prime minister congratulated Albanese in a tweet saying, quote, of your many promises to support the Pacific, none is more welcome than your plan to put the climate first. Our people's shared future depends on it. For more, we're joined by Tim Flannery, a leading Australian climate scientist and activist and one of Australia's leading writers on the climate crisis. Before Australian voters headed to the polls, he wrote a piece for the New Statesman headlined, Will the Australian Elections Finally Spark Action on Climate Change? Well, Tim Flannery, it's being called a green slide. Can you explain what happened?
Sure, Amy. And could I just say how great it is to be back with you again on this landmark day. So what we've seen in Australia is a really fundamental shift in really the way politics operates in the country. You know, we saw half a dozen of the safest conservative seats in the nation won by green independent candidates, most of whom were younger women, professional women with a deep concern for climate, social equity, and for anti-corruption measures in the Australian parliamentary system. So that was a fundamental shift. Can you imagine what it would mean in the US if half a dozen of the most kind of safest Republican Senate seats went to people like that? Well, that's what's happened in Australia. We've also had a real renewed vote for the Greens. Their vote is up much higher than it's been in recent years. They look like they'll have four seats in the lower house. They may even hold the balance of power in the new parliament, although that's as yet unclear. And, of course, Labor won. And Labor, although it's had rather, I would say, muted policies in terms of addressing climate change, they are far better than the Conservative Party that has lost power now.
Talk about the Teals.
Well, the Teals are the most fascinating phenomenon that I've seen in my time in Australian politics. I was involved with the very first Teal. Her name is Zali Steggall. She won the seat of the Conservative or arch-Conservative ex-Prime Minister Tony Abbott in Australia at the previous election, and she has now won with an increased majority. It's very clear that that seat is not going to go back into Conservative hands anytime soon. She's now joined by five other younger women, all professionals, corporates, people in the philanthropic sector and so forth, and they have all beaten Conservative members of Parliament. So the equivalent of your Republicans. And this has been, it's such a fundamental shift. It's sort of hard to understand how you go from that far right position to what appears to be a left position.
And then explain the term teal, blue, green.
Well, blue is the colour of the Conservatives in Australia. And if you take blue and mix a bit of green with it, you get teal.
When you say Conservatives, Conservatives are liberal in Australia?
That's right.
And Liberals are conservative.
It's terribly confusing, exactly. The Liberal Party is our Conservative Party, so it's our equivalent of the Republicans. Their colour is blue. But the Teals, although they represent fiscal responsibility and so forth, they really care about climate, about accountability within the parliament and anti-corruption and so forth, and about equity, gender equity. So teal was the right colour for them.
Explain Australia's dependence on coal and the world's dependence, where Australia stands in terms of coal and gas exports.
Sure. Well, look, Australia is the world's largest exporter of coal by calorific value because we have very high calorie coal and also of gas. So they're important in terms of the Australian economy, but the economy itself is far broader than that. So, you know, we all know that both coal and gas have a limited tenure. There'll be big changes globally within the next decade in terms of their use. And what the Labor Party and the Teals and the Greens all recognise is that we need to transition our economy from what dependency it currently has on those fossil fuels to new industries. That may be hydrogen, it may be direct export of electricity, it may be minerals processing using clean energy. We don't know quite yet, but we see there is a real need for that transition. And that need was simply not recognised by the Conservative government. They were saying coal and gas were going to go on forever. People in the coal electorates and the gas electorates where these things are mined knew that this just wasn't true. that, in fact, there was going to be a limit. We have lived through the most catastrophic climate in Australia since the last election over the last 3 years. And it's very clear now to people that change is absolutely essential.
You know, Tim, we met so many years ago in New Mexico, which has had these terrible fires. But if you can talk about what has happened in your country of Australia for the world to understand the impact of the climate crisis. I mean, climate is not at the top of voters' concerns. Maybe it's based on the kinds of questions that are asked in the United States. But to understand the profound impact climate has had on your country.
Well, look, the polling is showing that climate is the most important issue at this last election. And that's come about in part because of the catastrophic impacts we've seen in Australia since the previous election just 3 years ago. So that began just after the election with massive wildfires. You know, before those wildfires, the largest area burnt in Australia by fire was about 2%. During those fires, 21% of the forest burned. Thousands of people lost their homes, many thousands, and only 10% of those people have managed to get back into a house since the event. 90% are still trying to build houses or living elsewhere, some of them still camping out. So a massive impact. And during those fires, our Prime Minister at the time decided to go on a holiday to Hawaii rather than face this catastrophic event that saw our Navy rescuing people off our beaches. I mean, if you hadn't seen it, you would think it was fiction. But it was absolutely true. There was thousands of people trapped by these fires that needed rescue by our armed forces. That was followed in quick succession by some of the most severe floods the nation has ever seen. Entire rural cities devastated by unprecedented flooding. And that flooding has gone on and on and on and on. We've now three or four major flooding events. It just seems to be relentless. And for people living in the cities, you might think they'd escape these influences, but we haven't. During the fires, our major cities were blanketed in toxic smoke and hundreds of people died. I mean, people at the beach were covered in ash as falling debris fell out of the sky on them. And with the floods, you know, Sydney, which used to be a beautiful yellowish sandstone city, the sandstones turn black because of the mold. People's houses are covered in mildew and mold. People are throwing out whole wardrobes worth of clothing. The beaches are unusable because of the runoff from sewerage plants and other polluted sources into the ocean. So life for Australians has changed. That lovely sunny country that I remember so well is a distant memory now, and it's very, very strongly felt by people.
Well, Tim Flannery, we want to thank you for being with us, leading climate scientist, activist, writer, professor at University of Melbourne, author of numerous books, including The Weathermakers, How Man is Changing the Climate and What It Means for Life on Earth, and The Climate Cure, Solving the Climate Emergency in the Era of COVID-19. Next up, this week marks the second anniversary of the police murder of George Floyd. We knew about George Floyd's death. What about his life? We'll speak with two Washington Post reporters who co-authored the new book, His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Stay with us.
What if I say that I can't breathe? In fact, I beg and I plead, while you need is pushing down on me. Is there more compassion for someone whose skin is unpigmented? Is it really a threat? Or maybe you need to look within.
Human 2 by Carly Harvey. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This week marks the second anniversary of the police murder of George Floyd. 9 minutes and 29 seconds. That's how long Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin pressed his knee into Floyd's neck on Memorial Day 2020. Floyd was handcuffed face down on the pavement, not resisting as he gasped for air, begging for his life. A teenager named Darnella Frazier recorded cell phone video of their actions and helped spark global protests demanding justice. Derek Chauvin was sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison for murdering George Floyd. Three other former Minneapolis police officers were found guilty of violating Floyd's civil rights as they ignored his repeated pleas of, "I can't breathe." Today, we remember George Floyd, the man himself, and his impact. He died in Minneapolis, but he spent much of his life in Houston, Texas, where he's remembered for his efforts to break the cycle of violence in his community by mentoring young men. This social media post from George Floyd, in his own words, captures the type of outreach he did.
I want to speak to y'all real quick. I just want to say, man, that I got my shortcomings and my flaws, and I ain't better than nobody else. But, man, the shootings is going on, man. I don't care. What hood you from, man? Where you at, man? I love you and God love you, man. Put them guns down, man. That ain't what it is, you know. God bless, man, and y'all hold y'all head up, man. You got parents out here selling plates, man, trying to bury their kids, man. Think about it, man. Love y'all.
Love y'all, or I love you. George Floyd, in his own words, repeated those words over and over as a greeting, as a goodbye. After his killing at the hands of Minneapolis police officers, there were protests worldwide and in all 50 states. In Houston, more than 60,000 people honored George Floyd. Mayor Sylvester Turner addressed the march.
Today, it's about lifting up the family of George Floyd. Say his name. Say his name. It's about lifting up the name of George Floyd.
Well, for more, we're joined by the co-authors of a new book titled His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Robert Samuels and Tolu Olurunipa are reporters for The Washington Post, whose deeply researched book tells both Floyd's own story as well as the history of the United States through this one man, who said since he was a boy, he hoped to touch the world. The book also addresses slavery, housing, education, health care, and, of course, police violence. Robert Samuels and Tolu Olurunipa, we welcome you both to Democracy Now! What an astounding journey you take us on. This is also simply a history book of institutionalized racism in the United States. Tolu, I was wondering if you can begin in North Carolina. Because that's where George Floyd was born. But you don't start with George, or as his family called him, Perry's birth. You go back to slavery times, to George Floyd's family enslaved in this country.
Yeah, and it's so great to be with you. And I'm glad you started with that question, because in order to tell George Floyd's story, we needed to rewind the tape to the 19th century. George Floyd's great-great-grandfather was born enslaved. That's how far back the records go in terms of what we were able to find. And his great-great-grandfather was born enslaved, but received his freedom after the Civil War. And he was someone who was hardworking. He worked incredibly hard in this country, and he was able to amass 500 acres of land in the late 19th century as a black man. And that is something that was almost unheard of. It made him one of the wealthiest black men in that stretch of North Carolina. And if this was a normal story, George Floyd would have been the heir to that fortune. He would have come into the world quite wealthy as a result of the generational wealth that passed down. That's how wealth is built in this country. That's how many people came into the world wealthy because of their hardworking ancestors. But unfortunately, George Floyd's great-great-grandfather had all of his land taken from him through fraudulent tax schemes and unscrupulous business deals by white farmers and white landowners who wanted to take advantage of him and didn't like the fact that there was a wealthy black man going around their community. This was the time of racial terror in the country at the turn of the century, around the time of, you know, the Tulsa race riots and a number of different things happening. And George Floyd's great-great-grandfather lost all of his land, and he was unable to pass any of that land down. And what did that do to the rest of George Floyd's ancestry? It meant the next couple of generations before George Floyd came to the scene were made up of sharecroppers who lived in poverty despite working hard for years and years and years. And George Floyd was not able to inherit any of the benefits of the hard work of his ancestors the way many people have been able to benefit from the hard work that's built up over generations. So this is an American story. It shows how American poverty works, how American wealth works. And George Floyd was on the wrong side of the line because of the color of his skin, because of the color of the skin of his ancestors. And it was important for us to show that. We also did a comparative analysis of the family that owned and abused Floyd's ancestors and showed how they were able to build wealth. They were able to be quite wealthy and pass down generational wealth. And that really explains how, even though people say slavery was a long time ago, it still has reverberations and impacts on the 21st century.
Robert Samuels, this is a profound book that everyone in this country needs to read. I mean, ultimately, it also goes to the issue today of reparations and what this would mean. But I'm wondering, the two of you, as black reporters, looking at the life and death of this black man, again, we all knew immediately about George Floyd's death. We did not know about his life. Talk about taking on this project, investigating George Floyd, and what you identified with and what you didn't, the different paths you all took.
Well, Amy, I'll tell you, this is the most important and consequential thing I've done as a journalist. And Tolu and I, you know, we have combined 30 years of reportorial experience. And the reason I thought it was important is that I learned over the course of doing this writing and reporting that the idea of systemic racism, I used to think of it as a dark cloud that just hung over us, a stain in the fabric of America. But it's something far more terrifying. When I was with these families and these people watching the trial of Derek Chauvin, not knowing how it would turn out, it started to feel like a force, a pernicious force that was threatening everybody, black, white. And we thought by digging into the story of Floyd's family, learning about George Floyd, who was a striver despite his own mistakes and despite having an American society that always looked on him as a threat, often looked on him as a threat, he still believed in the promise of this country. And we wanted to be able to show readers about the cards that are stacked against people like George Floyd. And, you know, it was a personal thing because people saw us and they saw two black men carrying this story. But because we are two black men, we understood a lot of the things that they were talking about emotionally. What we hoped for is that people would understand not just the emotions, but the history and be moved to move and think about these ideas in different ways.
Tolu, you have George Floyd's family. He's named for his father, George Floyd, moving from North Carolina to Houston. And then you show the systemic, the institutional, the structural racism of what he enters when his family, when he ultimately grows up in Cooney Homes, the largest housing project and, you know, overwhelmingly African-American in Houston. If you can lay that out for us, and I can't help but think as I was reading your book this weekend, how many school districts might ban this book. Because you're directly addressing structural racism in this country.
Yeah, we are journalists and we wanted to tell the full story, including the story of structural racism, which was a part of George Floyd's life. Inarguably, it was clear that Floyd moved into a housing project that had been created specifically to house black people during the late 1930s. It was during the time of segregation that this housing project was created, and it was allowed to fall into disrepair in part because its residents were 99% black. And over those four decades before George Floyd moved there, that housing project became this sand trap of poverty where most of the people living there were below the poverty line, where the government had essentially given up on this large housing project. And it was riddled with crime and all kinds of problems that made it a place that was hard to inhabit. It was a place that was hard for George Floyd and his family to live and have a normal lifestyle and have a normal childhood. And when you're growing up in that kind of community where you feel that government neglect, it's hard for you to have ambitions and to have dreams. Now, George Floyd did still have dreams as an 8-year-old. And we spoke to his second grade teacher. We knew that he wanted to be a Supreme Court justice. We knew that he was meeting all of his national benchmarks on reading and writing and math, despite his impoverished background, despite the fact that most of his peers were falling behind. He was someone who was able to catch up and, at least for a brief period, was able to show that he had that potential. Now, when you continue to live in that kind of community, when you continue to go to underfunded, segregated schools, it's going to be hard for you to continue to maintain grade level. And that's what happened to George Floyd, especially as he got taller and as he got bigger. People looked at him and said, this school thing is not going to quite work for you because the schools that you're in are not well funded. They don't have the resources to get you out of here. But you have a body that can get you out of this community. It can take you to great wealth if you condition that body and if you work it on sports, if you go to the football field. And that's the story that he was told. That's what, as a child, he bought into. And he did focus on sports. And there was a time where it looked like he was on his way to great sports stardom. But unfortunately, because his education wasn't strong enough, he wasn't able to capitalize on his body and he wasn't able to capitalize on his athleticism. And he found himself going back to the CUNY Homes Housing Project, where he didn't have a college degree, he didn't have an income, he didn't have a job. And then the next thing waiting for him was the criminal justice system, which was tailored to target people like him, who looked like him, who came from the backgrounds that he came from. And lo and behold, he ended up cycling through that system for much of his life.
I mean, even as a young person, though he was extremely tall, he actually tried to compensate, you write, for looking in any way ominous. And that took away from him being an effective athlete, you know, as an aggressive football player. They felt he wasn't aggressive enough. He was always trying to reassure people that he was not threatening, Tolu.
Yeah, he would walk into a room and shake everyone by the hand and look everyone in the eye. And he told his brother, because his brother asked, why do you always do that? Why do you go into a room like that? And he said, I can't go into a room the way you do because people will be intimidated because of my size. I have to put them at ease. That's why he went around saying, I love you, in part, because he wanted to make sure people felt comfortable around him. And yes, on the football field, he was a jokester and he was somebody who the coaches tried to toughen up because they realized that he was big, but he didn't have this aggressive, domineering personality. It wasn't the kind of person that would try to exploit others because they were smaller. And so that was always part of his personality. And that's why it was so tragic in some ways for the people who knew him to know that the police officers that killed him saw him as this big, intimidating force, this person that was going to show excited delirium, that was going to, you know, rise up from the ground and start, you know, menacing them and menacing other people in the public. That wasn't his nature. And even while he was being arrested, he said, I'm not that kind of guy. And part of that was because he knew his body put forward a certain stereotype. And he wanted the police officers to know he was not the kind of guy that they stereotyped him as.
I wanted to turn to Philonis Floyd, his brother, named for his father. They shared the same mother. When he was joining protests to demand justice and calling on lawmakers to take action, this was less than a month after his brother's murder. And Philonis traveled to Washington, D.C. to address the House Judiciary Committee in person.
George always made sacrifices for our family. And he made sacrifices for complete strangers. He gave the little that he had to help others. He was our gentle giant. I was reminded of that when I watched the video of his murder. He called all the officers, sir. He was mild-mannered. He didn't fight back. He listened to all the officers. The man who took his life, who suffocated him for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, he still called him sir as he begged for his life.
So that's Perry, that's George Floyd's brother Philonis testifying before Congress. If you can talk about his encounter with the criminal justice system, you also, through it, tell the story of private prisons as well, being held at Hutto. Many in Texas know the Hutto prison. And actually, Hutto was named for the man who would found, am I right, the Corrections Corporation of America, CCA.
Yeah, I can jump in there as well. We wanted to show how these systems operate. It's not happening in a vacuum, that millions of men, including hundreds of thousands of men that look like George Floyd, were swept into the criminal justice system. There was also a profit motive for some of the for-profit prisons that benefited from the mass incarceration system. They benefited from the idea that you would lock up as many people as possible, spend as little as possible doing so. And, you know, there's a profit that can be made there. And it goes back to the history of convict leasing. It goes back to the history of slavery. And we draw that link between what was happening in the 1800s and what is happening in the 20th and the 21st century. And George Floyd got caught up in that. And even as he agonized over his mistakes and he talked about feeling sorry for the decisions that he made, it's, some of them led him to having a criminal record. He also felt that he didn't get a fair shake. He had to plead guilty in all of his cases. He never faced a jury of his peers because he couldn't afford a lawyer. And he felt that looking the way he did, he would never get a fair shot at trial. So he always pled guilty, even when in some cases he told his friends, I didn't do this. And some of the police officers that charged him were later charged with falsifying arrest on lots of people and charged with falsifying the arrest of George Floyd himself. So he was caught up in that system, and there were people making money off of that system. And America decided to continue to enforce that system as our incarceration rate shot up to becoming the highest in the world by far. And millions of people ended up being locked up behind bars, including several for nonviolent drug crimes, in a scheme that we're just now trying to unravel.
So we're talking to Tolu Aluranipa and Robert Samuels, the co-authors of His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice, on this second anniversary of the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, which takes us to Robert. From Houston to Minneapolis he goes. He had been arrested for and imprisoned for selling drugs. He also used drugs. And it was this cycle of drug use that he was constantly trying to break, that his family was trying to get him to break. He would also try to break the drug use of members of his family. Take us to Minneapolis and what he hoped for, going there not to sell drugs, not to take drugs, but to try to start life again.
Right. Well, George Floyd, when he was in Houston and when he was incarcerated in Texas, they had moved from thinking about having safe beds to help rehabilitate folks with drug dependency. And when he comes out of prison, he's looking for a job. He can't get one because of his record. You can't have something. You can't even have many professional licenses. You can't become a barber in Texas at the time if you had a felony. And also, he had no health insurance because Texas had decided not to expand insurance after the passage of the Affordable Care Act. So George Floyd, he becomes a part of a group of men who are led by a pastor who try to rehabilitate themselves, who try to find a way to get clean. And the pastor tells him that if you want this for yourself and your family, there's a place in Minnesota. And so he goes to a center, a rehabilitation center, to be able to get his life back into order. And when he comes out, he is clean, he's sober, he's working two jobs. He finds a house in a nice part in a suburb near overlooking sparkling waters. And things are going pretty well for him. But one of the things, Amy, is that there are things that, as a Black man living in America, you can't escape. And the residue of that racism that you had lived with all your life continues to haunt you. And so one of the things that happens in Minneapolis is his roommate, who was in rehab with him, he dies of a drug overdose, which puts George Floyd in a dark place. And we go through the minutiae of that in the book. But he's in a system where if you're white and you are living in a suburb, there was a lot of interest in helping to rehabilitate you. The federal government put billions of dollars into treatment and education and research about the opioid crisis when it hit white suburban communities. But if you're black and the state health department acknowledged it, they completely missed the alarming rise of use of opioids within black communities to the point where they started out, the rates started becoming higher than whites. And a part of that has to do with the way we were thinking about drugs at the time. It is true that when they passed the crime bill in the 1990s, there was money dedicated to research and funding and education for black communities. But when we looked at the records and when we went through the registrar, that money was never sent from the federal government. And so he was living in a world where he was trying to get better, but there weren't a lot of supports to do it. And as we know, through everything that we've seen, the actual physiology of how a person responds to a substance use addiction does not change whether you're black or white in this country. What changes is how a person is treated. And that's what happened with George Floyd.
So, Robert, you do some really interesting investigation into cortisol. People might be like shaking their heads. What are you talking about? Explain.
Yeah. So in the early 70s, there was a lot of effort put into thinking about something called high stress coping, right? And it was about maybe if you're working too hard in the middle class, something bad might happen to you. You might get a heart attack. And there was a small group of public health researchers that started positing the questions about the black body and what stress does to them. And it turns out that no matter your educational status, your socioeconomic status, your income, where you grew up, if you look at stress hormones in black people, those are things like cortisol. That's the stuff that triggers the fight or flight response. Those rates, the stress hormones, are at elevated rates. So if your stress hormones are elevated for a little bit, it's not that bad of a thing. It can help you pass a test. It can help you do a feat of strength when you need it. But if they remain high, that raises inflammation in the body. So that means you're more susceptible to things like heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, two of the three things that George Floyd had. And the conclusion is that the stress of racism in this country and in others can make you sick. And that stress comes with dealing from discrimination, fearing microaggressions, feeling you have to work twice as hard to get by as a white man, you have to work twice as hard. And also the fear for your life, the fear that you might encounter one of the wrong police officers who might kill you one day. Racism can make us sick.
Which is exactly what happened to George Floyd. I mean, if you go through the men who were killed by police in Minneapolis before Perry, before George Floyd, he was very aware of this and affected by it. One of the things in this book that's so enraging is the record of Chauvin. I mean, this doesn't take responsibility from, you know, all over the country and police violence, but that over and over again, he abused people and was never called on it. Explain that record. And I should say we have about, you know, 5 minutes left in this interview, and I really want to get to so many issues here. But the pervasive racism that had to underlie the Minneapolis Police Department for him to have gone after so many people, almost in the same way as he went after George Floyd and not be called on it. And then train people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one thing I have to say is Derek Chauvin's record as a police officer was not unusual for that precinct in the amount of complaints he got, which is a part of the issue, right? The second thing is that Derek Chauvin himself had a track record of aggressive behavior, that there were complaints. There is no public documentation that anything ever happened with those complaints, including several uses of the neck restraint, suffocating someone, that went on. He started using that restraint. The first instance we know happens about 18 days after he was trained for it. George Floyd was the ninth person he used that that technique on. Now, the interesting thing is, as Derek Chauvin continues to use this technique, it becomes more aggressive. And there's no record that anyone ever course corrected him. And it became more aggressive until he actually killed a man. So one thing that, you know, we say is systemic racism corrupts us all. And it has an impact on Black people. It also has an impact on white lives as well. Derek Chauvin was in a system that made it seem like it might be okay to do this to somebody.
You spoke to, well, now Governor Tim Walz, who warned you the momentum to make legislative changes to reduce racial inequality might have expired. As we hit the second anniversary of the police murder of George Floyd, Robert Samuels, what is your sense?
The sense is that if you are a person of color in this country, and we talk about this in the last chapter where Tim Walz makes that comment, you cannot believe that the future is so bleak, because that would be too bleak. It could cost you your life. And so we've seen some small changes on the legislative level, at the state and local level, and now we're seeing a backlash to it. Books that people were saying everyone should read in 2020 are now the books that are being banned in 2022. And when we talked with Reverend Jesse Jackson about this, he said to us, you have to consider the course of history. You have to look at the fact that progress comes in fits and starts, but people keep on moving, and we are moving toward a better place. We hope that with this book, once people can realize the context of George Floyd's life and also remember why so many people took to the streets in the name of a better tomorrow, that they might also start thinking about systemic racism and how people can see folks in a fullness that George, with a fullness and a grace that George Floyd never seemed to fully get.
Tolu, as we begin to wrap up this interview, you are a Nigerian-American journalist, the first reporter of Native African and Nigerian descent to cover the White House. You've said you felt convicted by Floyd's story. Explain what you mean as we wrap up.
Yeah, there is a common saying among people of faith, there but for the grace of God go I. And that was a refrain that was in my head as I read this story, as I learned about George Floyd, as I wrote this book, in part because I knew that I had received a number of lucky breaks in life that allowed me to have a different pathway of George Floyd. And it was clear that it was important to write this story with empathy, because any of us can experience hardship in life. Any of us can experience structural barriers in life. It's very uncommon for anyone who might be watching this to have experienced the number of hardships and structural barriers that George Floyd did, in part because that's the way systemic racism works. It operates in the background. It operates behind the scenes. And we wanted to shine a light on those systemic barriers. Even for people who have had better experiences in this country, it's important for us not to leave behind the millions of other George Floyds that are operating in silence, not getting the same attention, and who are experiencing some of the same struggles and troubles that he did during his life. And I know that as a Black reporter, it's important for me to shine a light on those experiences, to make sure that people's voices are being heard, people's experiences are being seen. And George Floyd's experience is one that we hope will get people to understand that we have a lot of work to do as a country. And one of the first things we can do is acknowledge our history, acknowledge our systemic barriers, and see what we can do about fixing and changing a number of them.
Did you feel more or less hopeful when you finished your book, Tola?
I have no choice but to feel more hopeful. That's the story of the Black American experience over the last 400 years. Hope is something that Black Americans have had to have. We've had a number of different times where we could have given up on this country. And if Black Americans were ever going to give up, we've had plenty of reasons to do so. But
we have to leave it there. But I want to thank you so much to both of you, Tola Oluwanipa and Robert Samuel.